Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. It has been 20 years since the Berlin Wall came down on November 9, 1989, reuniting a country that had stood as two distinct nations for 40 years. Mary Serratti, professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, addresses what happened after the fall of the wall, who benefited, who was duped, with Spiegel Online's political desk editor Klaus Christian Maltzahn. Maltzahn began asking what aspects of 1989 she saw as most important.
I see 1989 not as an ending, but as a beginning. What interested me was the question, what happens when there is a complete breakdown of political order? What does the day afterward look like? The wall coming down was actually the start of a competition. It was the start of a competition to define the new order. This was a very fast process that took place amongst great disorder, but it was extremely competitive. And there were a lot of players involved. I kept seeing political actors at the time using the language of architecture to describe what was happening. So Gorbachev would talk about a common European house. Kohl would talk about a Germany under a common European roof. Baker and other Americans, Zelig, would talk about a transatlantic architecture. I kept seeing this metaphor again and again, and I realized that it was a very useful metaphor and that it was possible to think of 1989 and 1990 as an architectural competition.
The German president, Horst Köhler, asked the question whether the revolutionary events of 1989 and 1919 were the consequences of great deeds by great men, or rather the achievement of the people marching in the streets and fighting for elementary democratic rights. What do you think?
I certainly think that it was a revolution both from above and a revolution from below. So I see in the year 1989 the pressure coming from below as being more important, the pressure from the streets, the role of the semi-free elections in Poland in 1989, the protests in the streets, particularly in Leipzig in 1989. I see that as being very important. Also earlier, the Chinese street protests. However, there's always a top-down role. In China, of course, the Politburo orders the People's Army to fire on the people. In Hungary, the reformist Hungarian government decides to open the border to Austria. They don't immediately open it to the East Germans, but that has enormous consequences as well. So that is a top-down decision. After the wall comes down, Mikhail Gorbachev is very much caught on the back foot. He had hoped very much to see reformist leaders in Poland, in Hungary, in East Germany as well. He did not want to see the complete breakdown of the Warsaw Pact, of the Cold War order. That was not what he expected. And up until that point in the late 80s, even though there are huge economic difficulties at home, on the international level, he's a brilliant success, right? He's not only Time Magazine's Man of the Year and 1990s Time Magazine's Man of the Decade, he's on his way to winning the Nobel Prize. Whenever he goes to the West, there's massive crowds of people overwhelming the cities that he's visiting. And
yeah,
so,
but he's pretty unpopular at home.
He's very unpopular at home, but on the international level, he is extremely popular. And all of a sudden, he's not driving events on the international level anymore when the wall comes down. He's caught on the back foot. He never recovers. He's starting to lose ground abroad as well as at home. So for him, it's a very, very difficult process. So what starts to happen is that the professional politicians start to move in. So once the wall comes down, once you have the complete chaos, then all of a sudden the very powerful people in the West, West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, French President François Mitterrand, American President George H.W. Bush, and of course their aides, secretaries of state, finance ministers, and so forth, then they get involved.
Kohl, who governed over the 16 years from 82 to 1989, is considered by most Germans as the reunification chancellor. His opponents and critics think, however, that he was merely very lucky. Nevertheless, Kohl saw the historic chance for reunification and went for it. Could some other German chancellor have messed it all up?
Well, to be fair, you have to ask the other question as well, which is, could another chancellor have done better? In my book, I assign quite a bit of importance to Helmut Kohl, and that will be more surprising to an American audience than it will to a German audience. There is a narrative developing in America that the Cold War is purely the result of American actions, particularly those of Ronald Reagan, and that the end game was completely dominated by the Americans until the end. But the end game is European. The end game is very heavily European. And in particular, the way that Germany reunifies is largely due to Helmut Kohl's personal and party preferences. Helmut Kohl realizes that he has the chance to become the Chancellor of Unity, as you say. And he doesn't realize that at first, because at first, in November, on November 28th, he proposes the 10-point plan. This is sometimes forgotten, but the 10-point plan didn't call for immediate unification. It called for a confederation. It called for the building of confederative structures between West and East Germany, and Kohl at that time thought this would take a while. If you look at the internal documents at the time, Helmut Kohl and Horst Telchik thought that it would only be with an enormous stroke of luck that they could make these things happen within a decade or two.
But they changed their mind when they went to Dresden.
Exactly. And then he goes to Dresden in December 1989. He has his basically first extended immersion in East Germany. I mean, he stopped, you know, particularly in West Berlin, East Berlin, but he goes to Dresden and he gets off the plane and there's people hanging out of the windows of the airport, and he basically says to his entourage, he says in German, "Die Sache ist gelaufen," which is in English roughly, "This is already a done deal." So even though he's ostensibly there to talk about confederative structures, he is changing his mind and trying to push for rapid unification. Another chancellor might have done that differently. He also believes very strongly in the importance of staying in NATO. Another chancellor might have seen that differently. The West, U.S. President George H.W. Bush, his National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, his Secretary of State James Baker, they are all extremely grateful that a West German who is dedicated to NATO is in charge of West Germany. One of the people I interviewed, Robert Hutchings, who worked for the National Security Council at the time, he got the tasking of drawing up a list of possible outcomes to German unification, ranked in order of desirability from the American point of view. And he came up with 18 possible outcomes, from number one, absolutely most favorable, to number 18, disaster from the American point of view. And what actually happened was number two. The disastrous outcomes, of course, would have been ones that involved a bilateral deal between Bonn and Moscow, basically exchanging NATO for German unification.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. You're listening to historian Mary Cerati talk about the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Nevertheless, there were a lot of Western politicians not exactly in love with the idea of a united Germany. George Bush was behind it, absolutely. But
yes.
Margaret Thatcher, for example, sometimes we had the impression that they even tried to sabotage the whole affair to some extent. Kohl always emphasized that a unified Germany was always going to be embedded in a united Europe. If you look at Europe today and the state of the European Union, do you think they could be backsliding in this regard?
Well, let me talk a little bit about the role of what was then the European Community in 1989-1990. The role of François Mitterrand in German unification is extremely important. There had been an understanding that Thatcher and Mitterrand were both equally opposed to German unification and equally overcome by it. They're certainly both shocked when it happens at the time. And there's definitely a period in November or December 1989 where they are very upset. Mitterrand sympathizes with both Thatcher and with Gorbachev, particularly after the 10-point plan, which none of them saw in advance. But Mitterrand, unlike Thatcher, realizes fairly early on in 1990 that the smart move for France is to get on board, is to support German unification and see what percentage there is in it for France. And he realizes that what's in it for France is speeding up European integration. Basically, Mitterrand makes clear to Kohl in the course of these events that if Kohl wants unification, what he, Mitterrand, wants for France and for the EC is a clear implementation plan to the euro, and he gets it. And so this greatly expedites European integration, it expedites the euro, it helps solidify European integration. So I see that year as a year that very much helped Europe to integrate more tightly and to make strides more quickly than it otherwise would have.
The Germans commemorate the fall of the wall every year. So every year the same story is told over and over again, the same politicians and witnesses are interviewed, the same stories are told. As a historian, how would you describe the current German narrative about 1989?
The events of 1989 are revolutionary, but in many ways the legacy is not. For example, we still have NATO. NATO is the quintessential Cold War institution. It was designed to counter the Soviet threat. So if you remove the sort of veil of hindsight and assume that there were other alternatives possible in 89-90, you can ask yourself, well, why does NATO still exist? And it turns out it's because Bonn and Washington very much wanted it to continue to exist. NATO is one of the most successful military alliances in all of history, so I'm not trying to denounce NATO. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that once you make that decision that you're going to perpetuate a structure from the Cold War world into the post-Cold War world, it has certain consequences. And one of them is it then perpetuates components of that conflict with Russia. So you still have something of a front line. Obviously it's moved, but you still have that. So now I think we're dealing years later with the consequences of some of these decisions that we understand more clearly than we did at the time. So that's what's interesting to me now about 1989 is we look at it slightly differently now from the vantage point of 2009 with Afghanistan, with Putin in charge, with de-democratization in Russia. The old story of 1989 ending, the wall comes down, it's a great victory, trumpet sound, happy ending, fade to black. Well, things look a little different.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal. Coming up, novelist Nathan Englander. Welcome back to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. Writer Nathan Englander spent 6 years living in Jerusalem between the two intifadas. The experience became the basis of several short stories in his first book, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, which he published at age 29, and his now novel in progress, Coward. His novel, The Ministry of Special Cases, takes place in Argentina during the country's so-called Dirty War in the mid-1970s. I ask Englander how geographical distance seems to help him get closer to the truth through fiction.
To really get intimate and to really get to the core of things and to really open up, you know, to just be naked in the fiction, to be telling, you know, the truest truths and going as deep as I can, I really like the distance of place. You know, so yes, I spend time in Jerusalem, but in a sense I write about, you know, the Jerusalem stories are, you know, sometimes set in a Hasidic world, and I did not grow up Hasidic, or, you know, in the collection they'll be under Stalin or, you know, historical settings, and Argentina is just utterly distant from my experience. So yeah, I think that really, yeah, that distance allows me really to open up. And I also like the idea, I just so deeply believe in fiction. I mean, I really do. I think it, you know, cures cancer and makes you taller and, you know, it'll take away wrinkles. Like, I think fiction can do anything. It's just negative space. It's words on the page. It's symbols. And you have to build from nothing. And you get to use what's there and what's not there. And the idea of foreign worlds is, for me, it's, you know, here we are talking in Berlin. You know, when you get to a city that's not your city, that's a new city, you wake up to everything. You see everything. You notice every sign and every cobblestone, and this is where a bike path is. You just have to learn to walk again and learn to see and learn how to ride a subway as a city person. For me, it's all new. And I think dreaming another place forces me to be aware of everything. Like, everything is considered. Nothing, you know, I could have written my Argentina book for 10 years and, you know, you have to just know, like, okay, January is summer in Buenos Aires. We're south of the equator. Like, even the seasons I had to relearn. And that to me is just gives me a heightened sense or heightened sensibilities in my imagination.
And what wouldn't seem like a foreign place for you? I mean, where are you from in the States? And what would seem entirely normal and a little bit more difficult to get outside of to write about?
I guess home. You know, when you think, what's the idea of home, the familiar, it's just remembering. You know, if he walks into the living room and takes 3 steps down, you know, like, you could have people falling into your living room in a story because you forgot to tell people it's sunken. You know, people just wouldn't know. Everyone would be walking into your fiction, reading along, and then they fall flat on their face because you forgot to say it's a sunken living room. You know what I'm saying? You have to put those steps in for them if you had a sunken living room. Yeah, I guess since it's imagined space, I guess it's not about a specific place. I'll tell you why this question, why I'm stumbling on this answer, because I think, as you move forward, what started to interest me, you become, I always talk about this stuff as playing your own graduate student. Like, you're never aware when you're building a world. The rabbis used to say this stuff about the Torah. They'd be like, oh, you know, like Reb Shloime, he rebuilt my motorcycle from pieces. You know, he took it apart and put it back together because he read that he knew everything. He fixed my air conditioner. He flew my plane. It's all in there. If you know that book, and in a sense, I like to think of fiction that way. I mean, I'm not comparing, you know, to the holy book, but as a concept where things get, if you build a functioning world, what I like about that concept, and that's a, you know, religious idea and a respect for one specific book, but for all books, that if a world is functioning, there are other things happening in it, you know? So you write a book about bridge and people say, actually, your book is really about math or basketball. Like, oh, it all better be in there if you've built a functioning, complete world. My obligation is to story. That's been clear to me forever. That's when the world's a confusing place to me. I think that's one reason I write fiction, because I'm utterly indecisive. Everything's confusing. Everything's overwhelming. And I like this idea of having to build a world, to decide. And this very clear thing, like my obligation is to the story. And that's very clear. If the story needs it, it goes in. It doesn't matter how much I love it. I like this monkish setup, but it doesn't mean I'm aware of what's behind the story. You know, I spent 10 years on this Argentina novel, and I know it's about habeas corpus, right? That's clear to me. I know about its government's gone awry. And then I think I get all smart in the middle and say, like, oh, yes, actually, it's a Jerusalem metaphor. It's a book about a father and a son. And so if it's functioning for people, but intimately about a father-son relationship, I wasn't aware of that, even though it seems shocking. They're like, come on. But that's not what I was looking at. And I feel like after I start to become aware of what things are about, whenever you become aware of something in your writing, it's no longer an issue, because it was only an issue before you were aware of it. You know, once that awareness is there, it means you're watching for any element. If you're like, you know, I'm too empathetic, or I'm not empathetic enough, you know, these things, once it's there, it's not a problem, because that goes off your list. So for me, this obsession where it's become really clear lately how safe I feel in the distance. I think when you ask me about what's close, why it becomes such a complicated thing, is I feel like I'm ready. That's the next challenge for me. Like, that's the book I'm setting out to write, this Jerusalem book. Instead of exploring these deep feelings about government and Jewish history and Israeli history and the Palestinians and the Israel, all this instead of exploring that in 1976 and around the world, I think I'm ready to write close, and that's both daunting and terrifying, which is usually the sign that it's the direction to go.
In both the books that we're talking about, the writing plays with themes of Jewish Orthodoxy, including your current translation of the Haggadah.
You know, we talked about this project, which is that Jonathan Safran Foer has had this idea to do a new translation of the Haggadah and a new edition, new commentary, all that stuff, and talked me into actually translating the body text. This is from the Baruch section. The Haggadah has 15 sections to it. This is from Baruch. This is at the start of grace after meal, so it gets it plenty of times during the year. A song of ascents. When the Lord returns us, the repatriated of Zion, we will be as if dreamers. It's then that our mouths will swell with laughter, our tongues be overspread with songs of joy. It's then they will exclaim among nations, magnificent is what the Lord has done for them. And magnificent is what the Lord has done for us. We were exultant. Return, Lord, our captives, sure as the wadis will course the Negev. For those that sow with tears, with joy will reap. Walks on the walker crying, bearing the sack of seed. Then comes the comer rejoicing, carrying his sheaves.
This is the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. We're talking with novelist Nathan Englander.
You know, this project that I was resistant to do, to open, you know, Jonathan said, you know how to read these texts. You grew up religious. You lived in Israel for a long time. You speak Hebrew. And it was just interesting to you know, sit in front of a pile of books all year and sit with my study partner, with Baruch, and just argue, you know, back and forth, you know, Babylonian style, I call it.
Did that feel like home in any way?
Yeah, well, that's it. It was interesting to so enjoy that, because I like books and I like words. I think that's part of how, you know, this love of books and story is what gave me a love of books and story. But it was interesting to, you know, like the Israeli writers, like David Grossman. He's had a study group for, I think, a million years at this point, you know, a secular guy. And it was the first time where I was able to say, like, I enjoy these texts, to access these texts, and to have this experience in a secular manner, to say, like, oh, I love this, and it not be, that would have been a really conflicted thing for me to do 10 years ago. Okay. It would have really creeped me out and thrown me, like, I don't do that anymore. So yeah, it's not a return to anything, but It's a real comfort with the familiar.
Mm-hmm. Did it feel familiar to be in Israel? Maybe you could talk just briefly about, you went there in 1996. Why did you go? How long did you stay?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I was just sleeping through State College. It was my roommate who was another, you know, we had a kosher room, you know, who were religious back then. And he just, you know, woke me up one day. He's like, you know, if you're going to sleep all day, you might as well do it in Jerusalem, like I'm going. I mean, no one in my family had ever been abroad. I had to go get a passport. It was the first time, I literally think since, you know, people came from Russia, you know, it was the last time anyone had been abroad. When it wasn't abroad, it was home. He dragged me off to Jerusalem junior year, and I just fell in love with being an expat and living abroad and with that city. And it's an intense and wonderful and beautiful and complicated and sad. Just everything in its opposite. It's a very complicated place. You know, it was just almost like a duckling. I mean, I think if I'd gone to Italy, I might have ended up in Italy for 5 years later. The overprotective mothers. It's very aggressive men. It's very similar. Very similar to the Israeli setup, but, you know, parliamentary systems that don't function. But yeah, so I guess, you know, it's almost hard to talk about now because it seems so far off, even though we've got, you know, Bibi Netanyahu's back in business, but...
You also said that it felt relatively small when you were there, that Netanyahu was in your gym or something.
Yeah, when I moved there in 96, we were going to make peace. There was going to be world peace. I mean, Rabin had already been, I'd been there, you know, in 95, the summer, 94, the summer. You know, I was in Iowa in grad school and I would go summers. I was headed right back. Rabin had been assassinated that November of 95. But I still believe we were making peace. It was an exciting time. And, you know, so, yeah, I went back to be part of this Aldous Huxley, The Brave New World. So, yeah, no, that was a huge inspiration for the Argentina novel, which I think, you know, where that metaphor split. But I hadn't understood that people run the world, that individual. I'd always assumed there was a master plan. Like, it might be messy and wars break out, but I assumed there were people with great logic and wisdom who were making decisions that affect us all and that you could sleep at night because your leaders were sensible people who had your best interest in mind, unless they were a Hitler or a Stalin, and then they were evil. So to me, it was this idea of, you know, my balcony in Jerusalem on both apartments just stared at the Knesset, at the parliament, and at the Beit Mishpat Elyon, at the Supreme Court building. And you see the government figures around, you know, the prime minister in his two cars, you know, with the security. It would race by my house every day, you know, the secure route down the same block every day, the two cars, you know, you don't know which one the prime minister's in. But it was just, I don't know, such a small world feel where I just started to understand at this time of chaos and bloodshed and, you know, super complexities and what I thought bad decision after bad decision on both sides. And to just understand, oh my God, these are people. This is a regular guy who lives in that apartment. You know, you go five blocks that way and hang a left, and that's where that guy sleeps. You know, where Netanyahu's like, you know what I'm going to do this morning? I'm going to open a door under the Temple Mount. You know, then by the end of the day, scores of people are dead. Like, I don't know what you're establishing is supremacy or, you know, this is our, you know, whatever. I'm going to make this point today. Like, I don't know, to strip away this idea of government and master plan and just, you know, whoever's whispering in someone's ear, who's ever making these decisions. You know, at the end of the day, like, those people are dead for real forever. To strip away all the aura of government and just see raw humanity, that I'm on this balcony and he's making that decision standing out on that balcony, it was massive education for me.
There's almost like an anthropological view you have of the religion that you were raised in.
That's the point. You hit it with the anthropological view because I'm not religious. I don't plan on being religious. I have no interest in that at all. But also, when I'm writing about Jews, it's not writing about other. That's what the world is to me. That's the world I was raised in. You know, I always give that example, like to have, an African-American writer say a black man walk through the door. Or I always say James Baldwin, like, gay writer, black writer, choose. You know, then he doesn't exist. Yeah. We are multiple identities. You don't have to identify. You're writing about people, you know. And for me, it's like this idea, you know, talked about this endlessly, but at readings where people, you know, we're going to have a Jewish audience get really mad if I don't want to identify as a Jewish writer. Like, to me, that's so limiting, as if it has to be genre fiction. Like, why is a Jewish man other? So, in a sense, up until now, I've been telling just stories about people. And in my world, you know, that's probably a default imagining of that is what normalcy is. So, I think this is the first time where I'm ready to look, you know, to look close. I'm always looking at story and character and, you know, this obligation to story, but this is the first time where a voice might have room to tell it like it is in a different manner, I guess.
Nathan, thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
Thanks for having me. This was a treat.
You've been listening to an interview with novelist Nathan Englander. This is the Berlin Journal.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor, host of A Prairie Home Companion, a live radio variety show every weekend with music and also Guy Noir, who's trying to find the answers to life's persistent questions, and the cowboys, Dusty and Lefty, enduring a life of privation and loneliness out on the open range, and stories about Lake Wobegon, the town where the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average.
We're back with the Berlin Journal. Gerhard Richter has long been a towering figure of post-war German art. His bold canvases, photographic experiments, and genre-leaping imagery have kept critics on their toes for decades. And art historian Benjamin Buchlow of Harvard University, a Daimler Fellow at the American Academy this fall, has been one of Richter's primary cheerleaders, even during the days when contemporary art in Berlin was not as hot as it has become. Isabella Graw, co-founder of the magazine Texte zur Kunst, sat down with Buchlow to ask about the less-than-vanguard German capital in the 1960s.
Berlin at the time was an absolute backwater for contemporary practices. With the exception of René Bloch, there was nothing to be done, or very few things and very few places to see contemporary art. Also, second backdraw was that the politicized generation of students, of which I consider myself to have been one, was, of course, violently anti-aesthetic in that moment, violently opposed to all cultural activities, almost, I would not say in a prohibitive manner, not even necessarily in an aggressive manner, even though there were, for example, the Documenta protests, but certainly in a definition of artistic practices as part of a larger project of cultural industrial practices that had to be totally reneged or at least ignored from the perspective of a political activism that was focusing on different questions altogether. So cultural production at the very moment of 1968 was looked down upon as something that was totally conciliatory and compensatory and had really no political function whatsoever. And least of all, pop art and the likes that came over from America were for the most part perceived by students like myself as emissaries of a newly emerging totalization of consumer culture in the guise of cultural representation. That perception changed when I moved to West Germany in the early 1970s after having lived in England for 2 years dramatically. And this was a very interesting transformation of my own approach to art historical practices or artistic practices.
You often speak about simultaneous reactions of disgust and enthusiasm. You know, hating and loving art in the same time situation. What does this tension actually mean? And
I wouldn't just blame 68 for the anti-aesthetic impulses. I would also go a little further into art history and say, once you've studied Duchamp carefully, you will never be cured of deep senses of doubt, skepticism, and at times rage with regard to the culture of artistic production. And there are many moments in the 20th century. You don't just have to construct Duchamp as the patron saint of anti-aesthetics. There are many moments in the 20th century, as we know, from Duchamp through the Soviets, through our own Berlin John Hartfield, where skepticism with regard to artistic practices was voiced in the most brilliant theoretical and practical models. And they are all in the back of my mind, I confess, at all times. And I walk around the world thinking, what would Marcel Brotas have thought about this, who is the next generation of one of the greatest artists of the second half of the 20th century, who was deeply driven by skepticism and polemics and doubt and derision with regard to artistic practices. So to answer your question, in my mind, the definition of artistic practice is integral in its link to a negation of artistic practice, in the way that Adorno, for example, as a theoretician, would have suggested that as well. But the artistic figures that I have known and studied and that have kind of formed my own approach were clearly defined in their own work by that dialectical model as well.
Why did you leave Germany?
Up to that time, and that might be hard to reconstruct, with the exception of Max Imdahl and Bernhard Kerber, there was nobody in Germany who taught 20th century and post-war contemporary art history at all. And there was very little, if anything, that was written that was worth reading. And I found myself for years on end reading American art history and American criticism. And I suppose that's partially even true for your generation still,
absolutely
20
true.
Years later.
Yeah.
And so when I had an opportunity to go to the United States, I went to the United States for the first time in 1971 as a visitor, and met quite a few of those people and met quite a few artists. And I was also very increasingly involved with American artists as friends and colleagues. And I had started to work on their work as an editor, as a curator, as a translator, and eventually as a writer and critic. I really felt that this approach to the definition of what contemporary cultural practice is was much more open and much more appealing to me. And that drove my decision to move there quite substantially. I mean, it was really the feeling that the field of contemporary art was infinitely more open. And I still have to say this is one of the most fascinating differences to study and think about, because it's not that easily answered. I think it still is even true now that in American contemporary culture, the sense of practice, that it intervenes in actual conditions of everyday life, that you are a feminist artist because you want to change the existence of women in cultural practice at large. That direct correlation has always fascinated me as an integral aspect of American artistic practices, whereas in Europe, artistic practice is, from the very beginning, sustained, concealed, autonomized within an apparatus, in an institution sphere, which is highly venerated, much more supported, much more taken seriously, but it's already aseptically comprised within an institutional and discursive sphere that ultimately has no claim to a direct link to pragmatic transformations anymore. Yeah, I might be wrong, but
there's no German Andy Warhol.
For example.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is Isabel Graw for the Berlin Journal, talking with Benjamin Buchlow. I was thinking that we could maybe look at Warhol and Beuys as exemplifying this difference. When if you only think of Warhol having operated in the factory and Beuys, who had the Beuys class institutionally, you know, institutionally conditioned in a way. And you could also think about Beuys as being, on the one hand, a political artist, you know, who ran for the Green Party, who was involved in all kinds of political activities, but who always made sure, you know, that his drawings would be produced and signed and satisfy a certain tactile need and so on. So these activities, in a way, ran parallel. And with Warhol, it's more messy, I would say.
Well, you would never say that Warhol posed as a shaman or as a leader or as a priest or as a sacred being or as a being of transcendental capacities, whereas Beuys played all of these roles, right? Warhol played a number of roles as well. He certainly transformed the image of what an artist is as dramatically as what Beuys did, perhaps even more dramatically. But it is quite interesting to compare the two, that the German figure recapitulates those roles of the leader, the shaman, the exceptional being, the genius, the priest, etc., etc. And he even posed in those roles, whereas for Warhol, there was never any doubt about the artist is a businessman, right? So, which is not any more palatable to me than the artist is a priest, right?
But it's different.
It's very fundamentally different. And I think it's very important to recognize that the two of them emerge at that same historical moment and kind of give us two models that, in a sense, are equally truthful and equally horrible at the same time, right? So, and I don't think there's much room for negotiation between the two, as we have since then encountered. And then there is, of course, another type of artist, that is the self-effacing, incredibly hardworking, absolutely shying publicity, Gerhard Richter, who runs an empire of painting, who says, I'm not a priest, I'm not a shaman, I'm not a businessman, I'm a painter, who insists on the traditionality of his means, of his role, of his identity, with the same fanaticism with which Beuys insisted on the shamanistic leadership. And not necessarily am I claiming that this insistence on the confinement of the traditional role of the painter has historically any more credibility than Warhol's vulgar display of himself mm-hmm. as a businessman. But there's a retreat formation in Richter that says, I'm not doing anything but paint. I'm not doing anything but art. I shy away from politics. I shy away from business. I'm only a traditional painter. That is the milieu, and that is the discipline, and that's the métier, and that's the discourse within which I operate.
Looking more closely now at the Richter operation, couldn't one still say that there are moments of businessman in his mise-en-scène?
Right. They are inevitable, right? I'm not sure whether they are in his self-find mise-en-scène, mm-hmm. and I'm not even sure whether he's deceiving himself about being a pure painter. I think mm-hmm. he really believes that he's a pure painter. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've asked myself many times the question, how is it possible that the proliferation of non-representational painting in his hands is so intense, right? I mean, he's producing immense amounts of non-representational work, very large paintings, and the criteria according to which such a painting is identified as a success or as an extraordinary painting are not easily available, right? Who decides and when is decided whether this is a great abstract painting or a not so great abstract painting is completely out of the reach of practically everybody. I think there are no criteria for us available to say the infinity of digitally combined colors generate an aesthetically pleasing result. And the same is true for the infinity of Richter's combined colors generate a pleasing result, mm-hmm. because we can't say it is warm, it is cold, it is tragic, it is melancholic, it is optimistic, etc., because we know, we just said, this is a color scheme, for example, if we talk about color mm-hmm. only, not facture and structure and composition mm-hmm. and order, we can't say why this is moving, beautiful, attempting, seductive, appealing, right? So that means we have no criteria, apparently we have no criteria whatsoever to say this is a miserable abstract Richter painting and this is a great abstract Richter painting. So that would then lead us to the suspicion that the proliferation of paintings resembles a little bit a money-making machine mm-hmm. because you can print money and mm-hmm. you can print abstract paintings at random, if you're in that position, once you become your own nation state, so to speak, you run your own economy as an artist, as a successful artist, you resemble somewhat your own monarchic existence that prints your own coinage, right? So I've asked myself that question over and over again, and I said, okay, that is a very difficult problem because infinity and utter openness are integral aesthetic conditions mm-hmm. for his work. Certainly would I never say that the proliferation of abstract paintings follows a market demand in his case. That is something that we just have to take his word for, his word in the paintings, not in his actual conversations, because he doesn't talk about this. But I would say the degree of Richter's absolute integrity guarantees to me that he would never lift a finger for a dollar in a painting. I've seen a studio full of about 20 large-scale abstract paintings 2 years ago, which when I talked to him about those paintings, he said, they're almost done, but I'm not sure whether they're done. I have to think about it more. And anybody, including myself, and I claim to have a pretty good experienced eye about Richter's abstraction manner, could have gone into that room with 20 large-scale abstract paintings and said, take them out, bring them to the museum, here's $20 million. 2 weeks later, I came to the studio and I said, where are the paintings? And he said, I destroyed them all. They were garbage.
Well, I would say that this moment is a bit like the residual illusionary freedom that artists need to believe in order to be artists at all.
It's a necessary and it's a productive condition. It's not an illusion. Mm-hmm. And now coming back to your overall argument, which I basically agree with, the tragedy is that if he would omit that last phase of the definition of subjectivity, the public would not mind, but he minds. He could have fobbed off those 25 paintings easily, and everybody would have said, this is just as good as the last series of abstract paintings. So the absence of criteria of utter authenticity in this moment of mm-hmm. self-confrontation that the subject performs, that Warhol abandoned, is not as necessary for the public reception as you make it sound. The public is perfectly willing to let that moment go, whereas the artist is not.
That was Isabella Graw of the magazine Texte zur Kunst speaking with art historian and critic Benjamin Buchlow. After the break, New Yorker staff writer and Holzbrink fellow George Packer talks Afghanistan, Obama, and the American way of war. Welcome back to the Berlin Journal. According to the New Yorker staff writer George Packer, Obama is treading dangerously close to losing public support for the war in Afghanistan. Such an event would force an unwelcome comparison to Vietnam, and no one wants to avoid this more than Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. Special Representative to the region, about whom Packer wrote in a New Yorker article this September. Packer is the author of the book The Assassin's Gate, about the Iraq War. He sat down with Klaus Christian Maltzahn of Spiegel Online to talk about transatlantic echoes in the unfolding Afghan debate.
Well, I think the U.S. debate is moving in the direction of the German debate, which is to say more and more people in the public and journalists and politicians are questioning the whole basis of having a lot of troops fighting a war in Afghanistan. And so in a way, the skepticism or impatience or skittishness of the German people, which has other reasons, historical reasons, is now being felt across the ocean in the U.S. But it's in a very different point, because for Germans, I think it's because you are, for the first time, finding that your troops are in combat and are killing and getting killed for the first time in over 60 years. I mean, Kosovo was the war in which there were no victims on the Allied side. Mm. It was a weird war in that way. This is more like real guerrilla war, and I think it's a new thing for the German public to find soldiers coming home in caskets and to have Chancellor Merkel giving out medals for heroism, new medals, I think. So these are familiar things to the American public. In fact, they've become too familiar. We've been seeing this for 8 years now, and it's not that it's new and shocking, it's that it's old and familiar, and the public is getting weary of it and is asking a lot of questions, what seems like an indefinite American military presence in Afghanistan. So it may seem as if the debates are similar, but I think they're coming from opposite points.
Right. During the election campaign in Germany, some politicians, especially on the left, were demanding an exit strategy for Afghanistan. The German government considers Afghanistan to be a toxic issue sometimes, an unpopular question which loses votes. This is the case in more and more Western countries which provide soldiers. Does Afghanistan have to be a toxic issue for politicians? What do you think?
What I've heard about the German discussion is that there really hasn't been much discussion, that it was not a big issue during the campaign.
They try to avoid it, absolutely.
Yeah, the German officials are doing everything they can to keep it kind of off to the side and not seen and not heard.
But then there was the airstrike, so it was on the table.
That made it unavoidable. But since then, has that led to vigorous discussion in the Bundestag? I haven't heard about it. What I continue to hear from diplomats, journalists, is that the election is not going to make a difference in the German presence in Afghanistan, and that the politicians are sort of continuing to... I heard that they don't use the word war.
They avoid it, absolutely.
To an American, that's really strange, because what else is it if it's not a war? But I guess what's happened is, for Germans, this was a peacekeeping mission, it was a reconstruction mission, and it has very slowly crept toward being a shooting war without the politicians wanting to say it. That's a dangerous situation, I think, because it means that you're not explaining it to the public. And if you don't explain it to the public, you will lose the public. Mm. I think a little bit of that happened with Obama. He came into office having promised to withdraw from Iraq and focus on Afghanistan.
Yeah, and FPAC, that was the miracle word. I mean.
Well, that was the word maybe coined by Richard Holbrooke. And in the first 2 months of his presidency, Obama had a review and came up with a new strategy. He gave a big speech in March, said we're going to do counterinsurgency, we're going to do reconstruction, we're going to focus on Pakistan as well, we're going to focus on the connections between the two countries. It was a very big, all justified by the need to get al-Qaeda. Okay, that was March. 6 months went by without a really serious speech by the president. And that period included the Afghan elections, which were a disaster and a real historical turning point for the war. And the president continued not to explain to the public why General McChrystal was asking for more troops, why the election turned out to be a fraud, what that meant for our strategy in Afghanistan. Silence. And you, if you're silent about a war where your soldiers are getting killed, you will lose the public. So I see the German and American politicians sort of making the same mistake. Right now, Obama is involved in this intensive review of his original review, and he doesn't want to commit himself until he's ready. So I understand the wall that's gone up around the Afghanistan policy, but I still think it's dangerous if time goes by and the public is never given an explanation for why we're doing what we're doing.
What do you expect to happen? And what do you think will Obama's speech be like?
It's behind closed doors and there's no leaks, so it's hard to know. But it's clear that there's a real disagreement between, say, military advisors and a couple of his civilians, like Hillary Clinton, and civilian political people in the White House, mm-hmm. Starting with Vice President Biden and some of Obama's political advisors. And this is something we haven't seen before since 9/11. A president who is not doing exactly what his generals ask for. You know, under Bush, the generals would say that we don't need any more troops when they did need more troops in Iraq. They said that because they knew that if they said we want more troops, it would make Donald Rumsfeld very unhappy. So they pretended. Then came Petraeus, who said, I need more troops. And he got more troops because Rumsfeld was gone at that point. But during that whole time, there was never an open disagreement between the civilian leaders and the military. That has now happened under Obama. I think it's a good thing. I think it's healthy for a democracy.
You're listening to George Packer talk with Klaus Christian Malten on the Berlin Journal.
How important are more troops? What do you think?
Well, originally, the strategy called for more support for the Afghan government, more training of Afghan troops and police, and more pressure on the Taliban. Counterinsurgency. I mean, that's why McChrystal asked for more troops, because he was assessing what it would take to carry out the strategy Obama gave him. And I think it's undeniable that if your approach is to secure the population, let's say in some of the centers of population like Kandahar, Lashkargah in the south, Kunduz in the north, Herat in the west, and Kabul and a few other places, absolutely they need more. Mm-hmm. Does that mean they have to be American troops? Could they be other NATO troops? Could they be more Afghan troops? Could they be moved? Could they be American troops that are already in Afghanistan, moved from one place to another? That's a harder question to answer, but absolutely there's not enough troops in Afghanistan. It has always been a war, as you know from having been there earlier. It's been a war that was fought on the cheap. Light footprint was the euphemism that Rumsfeld used, but it turned out that certainly at the beginning, Afghans wanted more than that.
In your recent article for The New Yorker about Holbrooke, you quoted an American battalion commander's summary of the Afghan war since 2001. He said, 7 years of unfulfilled promises to the Afghan people. He went on, for the first time we are doing counterinsurgency here. That's an unbelievable statement after 8 years, I guess. Is it already too late to regain the military and political initiative in Afghanistan? What do you think?
I think with some Afghans it is too late, yeah. I think with some, especially people in the south who have family and tribal and geographic ties to Taliban and who've been on the receiving end of NATO's power without seeing the benefits of NATO's power and who have a, if not an Afghan nationalism, at least a Pashtun nationalism that is getting stronger and stronger. Been talking to an Afghan, a German expert named Thomas Rutig, who has been focused on Afghanistan for 20 years, and he thinks it is too late in those areas, that you can't simply say better counterinsurgency will turn the war around. And in that way, there may be an intellectual flaw in McChrystal's report, because McChrystal assumes that Afghans want protection from NATO with improved performance and more concern with Afghan lives and Afghan sensitivities, but I'm not sure that I don't think that's true in some places. In other places, I mean, I know it's true because I've talked to a lot of people in and around Kabul. But that's, you know, it may be that Afghanistan is sort of turning into a city versus country war, where you have people in the cities looking to the central government and to NATO for help, for services and security. And people in the countryside, especially south and east, more and more alienated from the central government. Mm-hmm. Because that's the other part of your question. Not just is it too late for NATO to do counterinsurgency, but is it too late for this Afghan government to convince its people that it's their government? And after the fraudulent election and years of broken promises and corruption and drug trafficking and all the things we know about and just non-existent government at the local level, it may be too late for Karzai as well. Mm-hmm.
You describe how Richard Holbrooke tries to avoid making the same mistakes in Afghanistan which the USA made in Vietnam. But then the whole situation seems to be much more complicated today in Afghanistan than it used to be in Vietnam or the Balkans. Have we lost the war already, although nobody in the West wants to admit it?
Well, that's a question that Obama's advisors really seriously asked when he began the first review in February and March. And I was impressed that they asked that question because it's a question that's politically difficult. It could make you seem defeatist, and no one wants to admit a war is lost. I mean, that's why Johnson escalated in Vietnam, knowing that it might destroy his presidency. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Obama wants this to destroy his presidency. I mean, I think he is more like Kennedy than like Johnson. He's going to make sure it doesn't destroy his presidency. He will not do something against his own better judgment because he's afraid to lose a war.
You've been listening to George Packer, a Holzbrink Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin and New Yorker staff writer, talk with Klaus Christian Maltzen of Spiegel Online. We also heard interviews today with historian Mary Cerati, novelist Nathan Englander, and art historian Benjamin Buchlow, who was interviewed by Isabella Grahl of the magazine Texte zur Kunst, in Berlin. The Berlin Journal is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and National Public Radio. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, please visit americanacademy.de. And for more on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide, please visit our website, nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Ralph Martin in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. We'd like to send out a special thanks today to Jeff Rosenberg, who launched NPR's Berlin station 104.1 FM in December 2005 through his tireless efforts. Jeff is retiring this month, and all of us at NPR Berlin, Worldwide, and at the American Academy in Berlin would like to wish him warm thanks and all the very best. Thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal. Auf Wiedersehen.